Hey, everybody, welcome back to First Thursday, the monthly podcast from Labor Relations Information System. My name is Rick Polson. I'm the executive director of LRES. I'm also your host. But if you're listening to this, I guess you already know that. All right. So it's the month of May 2026. Lots of interesting stuff going on LRES wise. We just did our collective bargaining seminar in Nashville a couple of weeks ago. It was a lot of fun. Love that seminar. You know, we hear from labor folks and management folks with different approaches to bargaining. Always learn stuff again this time. We have some upcoming seminars in Vegas in June, at the end of September, beginning of October. In June, we have Rights of Police Officers from June 17th to 19th. In September and October, specifically September 30th to October 2nd, we have our Enforcing the Contract Grievances, Discipline, and Workplace Rights seminar. So that's enforcing all of it from the union side, from the management side. How do we actually like enforce these things that we bargain, or these rights that exist out there somewhere in the law? And then in November, we're going to be back in Vegas. In November, we're going to be in Nashville again for the second time this year for our best practices in public safety discipline. That's November 4th to 6th. So lots of really cool stuff happening at our LRS seminars this year. Hope to see you there. So last time when we were in Nashville, the 76ers were in the play-in tournament for NBA playoffs. I am sitting here talking to you from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I am a long-suffering Philadelphia sports fan, although suffering hasn't been as much as bad recently with respect to football. Go Birds. But basketball has been tough, and I have a dysfunctional relationship with the Philadelphia 76ers, always have. And I always think that, like, if you grew up in the kind of neighborhood and the kind of place where I grew up, or maybe if you didn't, relationships to your hometown sports teams are kind of like relationships to your family. Like, you know, I love them, I don't necessarily like them, but I'm stuck with them forever, you know, and that's how I feel about our teams, including the Sixers. So Sixers had a good, nice victory over the Celtics. Sorry, Boston fans, over the weekend. And I'm talking to you on Monday, the 4th. And in a few hours, the Sixers are going to tee it up with the New York Knicks, and it should be a lot of fun. So by the time you listen to this, we might be two games up, two games down. Who the hell knows? The big story is, Rick, why are you even talking about the Sixers? There is a point to this. And the point is, when I watch those games, I am just like overwhelmed by the number of sports betting app ads, right? It's just like constant. DraftKings, Fanatics, you know, all of those things. It's just constant. And it, you know, this is a recent thing. If you think about it, over the last few years, it's only been a few years that, you know, sports betting, you know, has been legal online in most states. And, you know, it got me thinking about that, you know, and, you know, I don't gamble, you know, hey, come on out to Vegas, you know, see us at one of our conferences. There's a lot of fun, and you can gamble the old fashioned way, and you can gamble on sports if you want, you know, but, you know, so I feel a certain way about gambling. I don't bet on sports, and I try to stay away from those online sports apps because it seems like it's a big recipe for problems potentially. I just saw an article. You know, we look at headlines, you know, covering things of issue in public safety, labor relations, and there was a story in the papers a few weeks ago coming out of New Haven, Connecticut, where their police chief, guy by the name of Carl Jacobson, was just indicted, just pled not guilty to embezzlement charges. He was arrested in February. And it's basically related to allegations that he stole $85,000 from the city. And, you know, pretty much that the allegation is that he was embezzling money from their narcotics enforcement fund and from their police athletic league funds in, you know, over an extended period of time, kind of smaller increments adding up to $85,000. And if you were to go by what the indictment says, these thefts related to payment of gambling debts. And so there's an underlying issue of a gambling addiction, allegedly for this chief. He had wagered about $4.5 million in 1 year, in the year where this was going on various gambling apps. He's in Connecticut. Online betting is allowed. Sportsbook betting is allowed there. There are three apps that you can use: DraftKings, FanDuel, and Fanatics. And the chief was wagering on all three of them. And he lost a few hundred grand. And so the allegation here is that he was stealing from the police department in order to pay those gambling debts. And one of the things that struck me in looking at the materials, because I had to take a look at it, and it was that, the sense was, we never saw you gambling. You're not the kind of guy to go out and gamble. And he said, no, it was all in the apps. It was all just on my phone, and it's a different world now. And it's something in the field of, in labor relations, in public safety, and really everywhere. But it's something that we have to be aware of. And what we want to talk, this is a special episode today. Well, next week or next month, we'll get back to the cases. But I want to talk about this issue of gambling and online gambling and gambling addiction, and how it may manifest itself in public safety agencies, and what we can do from the union side and from the management side to maybe try to get out front of it or deal with it. And what legal protections are there, in effect for these things? And so, between the Sixers in the playoffs and this chief, getting jammed up for online gambling, it's got me in that headspace. Let's talk about the apps a little bit and just sports betting, generally, just by way of background. Sports betting has been legal, right, at the state level since 2018. Some of you guys might, be aware of this law called the Professional and Amateur Sports Protections Act. And it was a federal statute, was enacted in 1992. It's interesting. We're going to talk about another law enacted around the same time during this podcast. But enacted in 1992, and who was behind it? Primarily the professional sports leagues were behind the law. And the law basically said that sports betting was illegal at, at the federal level. And, the energy behind that legislation was from the professional sports leagues. And why did they not want to have betting in professional sports? Well, ask Pete Rose, or ask anyone else. Like, it was to protect the integrity of the sport. That was the idea. And so you could do any number of things, but you can't bet, right? You can't bet on baseball. You got a problem with that. And that's where all the energy was, with respect to gambling. And man, 1992 wasn't that long ago, but everything has changed. And so there were a couple of attempts over the years to challenge the constitutionality of that law. And normally those attempts were brought by states, or by groups alleging that the federal government engaged in overreach and that that requirement violated the 10th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. And when people start talking about 10th Amendment rights, or if you hear that, that generally is going to get to this tension between states' rights and the rights of the federal government, right? This is the oldest, there's that tension. There's tension between the courts and the executive and Congress. And like, these are these, disputes or relationships that kind of get to the heart of the rule of law in this country. And so, what can the federal government do? What can states do? And ultimately, there was a case, an unsuccessful case out of New Jersey, in 2015, was brought again by different plaintiffs, in a case that went before the Supreme Court in 2018. And in 2018, the Supreme Court decided basically that PASPA was unconstitutional, and that essentially the question of whether and how to regulate or maybe criminalize sports betting was a matter left to the states. That wasn't for the federal government to decide. That was something for the states to decide. And that opened the floodgates. So that was what made it a thing. Right? Okay, now we can, we can bet everywhere. And the question went back to the states. Just like with marijuana that we talked about on the podcast, it's kind of why we're talking about this too, because I feel like we talk about marijuana and we're, in a sense, we're ignoring something that's even bigger, and has maybe a further reach, and that's gambling, tons of money behind gambling. You can call it gaming if you want. You know, you take a B and an L out, it's still the same thing. It's just, it's gambling. And in that short period of time, there's like 40 states that permit sports betting. It's 39 states and the District of Columbia. By the way, that's about the same number of states that have essentially legalized marijuana. So, you know, for at least for medical reasons, there's 40 states, 24 for recreational. So we've got like these 40 states where you can bet on sports, and we've got 40 states where you can use marijuana legally. They're not all the same states. It's close overlap, but they're not all the same. 30 of those 40 states allow betting apps, right? And that's where the action is. The other 10 states is like a mix of like retail sports books and like tribal only kind of sports books. But the, you know, where most of the action is on the apps, right? The DraftKings and all that kind of stuff. That's where you see the commercials. You know, why are they sponsoring everything? You know, why are they spending so much money on marketing? And why do you see the sports betting apps everywhere? Because they're making tons of money. Depending on where you look for your data, it looks like about 90%, you know, some say more, like closer to 95% of all bets are now placed online. We go to Vegas all the time, right? You know, and that's where you used to have to go, but now you can do it anywhere, and you can do it, you know, on your phone, man, the privacy of your own phone. You don't have to go anywhere. You don't have to wear pants to bet. You know, you can just kind of do it on the app. And you know, what we know is that gambling's fun. It can be good fun. You know, it's competitive. There's all kinds of interesting and fun ways to bet on sports, but it also is addictive. You know, it can be addictive. And it's not just, you know, something that we suggest. I mean, there's tons of science behind this. An interesting JAMA study that came out just last year, right, in the wake of this, you know, really fast, you know, expansion of sports betting rights, showed a 61% increase in like Google searches and other searches for gambling addiction and gambling addiction assistance following the introduction of online sports betting, right? So we've got like this, you know, your state enables you to bet through certain sports books online. And then there's a 60% increase in like people Googling, I need help for gambling addiction. And so there's got to be some connection there, right? There's more access and there's more concerns. And our law enforcement folks, you know, I'm sure that you've seen many, many instances, you know, of people, you know, stealing, getting jammed up, just like our chief in New Haven, in relation in some way to gambling. Doesn't mean that there isn't a role for like personal responsibility, right? People should follow the rules. But, you know, we do know that, you know, people wind up, they got debts that they can't pay. They're going to find some way to pay them while they're trying to keep their heads above water. And gambling is behind a fair number of those things. We've got a particular concern among younger people, right? And a lot of that's just tech-based. This is something on your app. There's plenty of people that might actually want to bet on their app and they have the foggiest idea how to download it or how to use it, you know? And so they're just going to go to the track or whatever. But yeah, you know, we got kids, you know, high school kids, high school guys are, you know, getting on and betting, and, you know, lots of, you know, friends who, you know, have to talk to their kids about that, right? And how to be responsible regarding betting or whether they're allowed to or not. So a big concern among younger folks and a big concern among our younger folks in police departments and fire departments and in prisons. It's a generation of folks who are used to betting online. And you know, what kind of problems, you know, can that cause? You know, the apps change everything, man. That privacy, you know, that comes with the phone in your hand, it changes everything. I remember, maybe this isn't a good analogy, but when I was a young lawyer, and I was at one point a young lawyer, you know, you'd get lots of examples of like people would do things at work and they might get fired or disciplined and union files a grievance and you get a case. And there's labor relations professionals who listen to this podcast. There's only about 1,000,001 ways that people can do stupid shit at work, right? That results in them getting disciplined. And one of the old favorites was porn, right? So porn at work and, you know, one way, shape or form, you know, whether people are printing stuff out or they're getting on a computer screen and leaving something on the screen or email porn or, you know, like people aren't that complicated. They still get jammed up for that kind of stupid stuff. But that was a category of case. At any given time, I probably have 5 or 6 porn cases, you know, it's just the way it was. And then they stopped, you know, the porn cases all just stopped. And, you know, did everybody just get more moral? No, what happened is like people got phones and they could get their porn on their phones, you know, through Wi-Fi, and they stopped messing around at work on their work computers. You know, I'll still get the occasional porn case if someone sees somebody, you know, watching porn in a vehicle or something, but it not anymore, right? So the tech changes the way people do certain things. By the way, never borrow anybody's phone. You know, but the tech changes things, and the tech changes people's conduct with respect to gambling, and it's private, and you can bet a lot of money and you can lose a lot of money, and no one's really ever going to know other than you and your phone and the bank that you owe that money to. And so it's a lot easier to hide conduct, and it's different in a lot of ways from other types of like substance abuse, you know, where people might see a drunk, right? Or you might be manifesting some types of substance abuse symptoms at work. What's harder to detect that with gambling. And so, you know, it's an issue. And just like this thing that we saw, you know, with this chief up in New Haven. And so it got me to thinking about, you know, what protections are there, you know, out there? What legal protections do we have? Or what contractual protections do we have or should we have around the idea of gambling, you know, addictions? And, you know, the answer is there's really not that much. You know, there really isn't that much out there. The starting point with any of this stuff would be the Americans with Disabilities Act, right? I think that we know enough as a culture now that people acknowledge that, you know, someone can become addicted to gambling. We're not just talking about like a moral failing. You know, and I'm not here to preach about any of that kind of stuff, you know, but I just think as a society, there's probably a sense, right, that, you know, we acknowledge that some people can become addicted to gambling. And there's science behind that, right? There's science behind that. And we're going to talk a little bit about that. And so if I have an addiction, if I have some type of disorder, some type of mental health disorder that causes me to gamble, and there are consequences to that, are there any legal protections that I might be able to avail myself of? And normally those types of protections are going to be found in the Americans with Disabilities Act, right? Is my gambling addiction a disability that may give me some rights with respect to my job? Let's stick with the job. So we've got this law called the Americans with Disabilities Act. If you're listening to this podcast, you know what it is. It was passed in 1990, right? So you know, the no sports betting law was passed in 1992. The Americans with Disabilities Act passed in 1990. You know, not the oldest law in the world, but it wasn't passed yesterday. And Title I of the ADA applies to your workplace stuff. And what the law says is that no covered entity for this, no employer shall discriminate against a qualified individual with a disability because of the disability, in regard to job application procedures, hiring, advancement, discharge of employees, employee compensation, training, and other terms and conditions and privileges of employment, right? That's, there you go. That's how a statute reads. But basically, an employer can't discriminate against a qualified individual with a disability because of their disability. And under the law, what the ADA is going to require, if you are in fact a qualified individual with a disability, the employer is going to have to engage in a process to figure out whether some reasonable accommodation is due that employee. So I have a back issue and I can do every other aspect of my job, but I just need to sit down every once in a while. And maybe depending on the nature of my job, it could be that a stool or enabling me to sit down for 10 minutes every hour might be enough that I can still get the job done despite this disability, right? So, you know, it's about finding a compromise so that the work can get done. And, you know, the ADA calls for an interactive process and the union can be involved in that. We try to figure out how can we help, you know, somebody get the job done despite a challenge, a physical or a mental challenge, you know, that they may be facing. And one of the first, you know, questions that we ask if someone says, hey, am I protected under the, you know, the ADA is, well, do you have a disability? And, you know, it's not just, do you have a disability? Do you think you have a disability? It's, do you have a disability as it's defined under that law? And it even goes a little deeper than that. Even if you have a disability, you still may not be entitled to protections. But this first question is, do you have a disability under the law? And We're not going to, you know, spend 20 minutes talking about the process that the EEOC uses when they're making that determination, because as it relates to gambling, the ADA has a couple of carve outs, you know, in the statute itself. And it says, listen, we've got disabilities. You're protected, you know, if you have a disability under certain circumstances. But there's some things that we're telling you right now, these are not disabilities under this law. So there are exclusions in the text of the Americans with Disabilities Act. Sometimes they're colloquially called the SIN exceptions, which is, I think it might be a little problematic to say that, but that's people just basically call them these SIN exceptions to the ADA. And what are they? So, and this, you know, boy, this reflects the times. The term disability shall not include, now, number one, transvesticism, transsexualism, pedophilia, exhibitionism, voyeurism, gender identity disorders not resulting from physical impairments, or other sexual behavior disorders. All right. One, the sex stuff. Congress is saying we ain't messing around with that other than when we're doing our own stuff, you know, in chambers. But so they carved out any sex things. Another thing they carved out were drug use disorders, you know, resulting from the current illegal use of drugs. That's a whole other podcast, right? And it may be another podcast about psychedelics, actually. The second, right, SIN exception specifically carves out three things: compulsive gambling, kleptomania, or pyromania. Really weird that those three things are together, right? But basically, Congress said, hey, we've got protections in effect, but we're telling you right now, you are not protected under this law if you are kleptomaniac, a pyromaniac, or a compulsive gambler. That's kind of weird. Like, why are those three things together? You know, what was going on at the time? You know, you read the legislative history, you learn a little bit about some of that stuff. A lot of the energy had to deal with HIV AIDS status and affording protections to folks in that situation. And so I think a lot of maybe the liberal energy, if you will, was focused there, maybe not on some of these other things. You know, if you were to look at the state of science, the state of medical science in 1990, as it relates to gambling, what you would find is that, you know, there was no separate kind of gambling disorder recognized, you know, by, there was no consensus definition for a gambling disorder in 1990. There is a journal that that governs these types of things. It's the American Psychiatric Association. I'm just laughing because I can't believe I know some of this stuff. The American Psychiatric Association has a book, you know, a manual that has been published for decades, and it's called the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, and we call it the DSM. And the current version of that is the fifth edition of that book, the DSM-5. So if you're ever talking about PTS or other things, like we spend a lot of time say, oh, it's DSM-5 definition of this or that. That's what we're actually talking about. And today, sitting here, you say, hey, Rick, is there some type of gambling recognition in the DSM? I would say yes. The DSM-5 recognizes a clinical condition that they call gambling disorder. And that's basically compulsive, repetitive gambling, you know, despite the consequences. It's not substance-based, but it functions very much like addiction, right? You've got, and there's like studies on like the reward pathways and dopamine, you know, and all that type of stuff. So it's like dopamine driven behavior, but it's not driven by a substance. It's driven by you gambling. So it's a real live mental health disorder. It exists. It's medically accepted as a real addiction. But that's sitting here today, right? In 2026. In 1990, gambling disorder didn't exist. And in fact, there was no DSM-5 back then. We were on DSM-3, and the third edition of the DSM didn't recognize a gambling disorder. Instead, what it recognized were these impulse control disorders. And there were a bunch of them lumped under that, including gambling, kleptomania, and pyromania, right? Those other things in the ADA exclusion. So basically what Congress did essentially was they had an exclusion for impulse control disorders as recognized by the DSM-3, right? Even though they didn't say that, that's what they did. The problem is since then, right? You know, in the 36 years since then, the science has changed. And so gambling disorder isn't recognized as just some impulse control disorder like kleptomania or pyromania, but it's its own disorder that's an addiction like any other. And so we have in the text of the ADA a statutory exclusion that's based on a medical understanding that no longer exists, but the law hasn't been amended to catch up, you know, to the science. That's not unusual. That happens all the time. But what does that mean? If you or a member suffers from a gambling disorder and you wind up having troubles at work, what it means for sure is that you can't look to the ADA for protection. The gambling disorder is not going to be recognized as a disability under the ADA, which means there's no right to accommodation. There's no interactive process. The employee can be disciplined for their conduct. The employee can be disciplined because they're a gambling addict. Aside from, you know, what they actually did, if there's some reason to believe you're a gambling addict, there's no federal prohibition in the ADA against an employer doing that in the ADA. Now, remember, you know, if you think about alcohol or other things that may be protected by the Americans with Disabilities Act, the ADA doesn't protect misconduct. So you still did what you did, right? You can't say, oh, I stole $85,000 from the police department. I'm a gambling addict. I have gambling disorder. Oh, well, you know, it doesn't work that way. And under the ADA, even if it did specifically cover gambling disorder, it wouldn't mean that you have a magic wand and you can make the bad things you did go away. But it does provide some larger, you know, protections. Maybe if you are struggling, is the employer required to let you go to rehab, you know, or get some type of treatment for a gambling disorder? Yeah, it would if it were protected under the ADA, you know, but it's not. You know, one area where we saw action for a while, and we don't really see any action anymore under the ADA as it relates to gambling, is the question of like, well, is the gambling the only thing going on, right? You know, a lot of times people have problems. They have lots of problems. We can bring six criminal charges for the same act, right? You know, so a lot of times we have overlapping issues. And so there are lots of cases where in order to, you know, try to win, plaintiffs have argued that it's not the gambling, the compulsive gambling, you know, that is the disability. The disability might be like depression or anxiety or things that can, in fact, have been recognized as disabilities in different circumstances. And that depression, let's say, manifested itself in compulsive gambling, right? So you try to kind of shoehorn it in that way. Lots of cases where plaintiffs have tried to do that unsuccessfully. There's a case out of Arizona, Raytheon in the defense industry. You had somebody who got jammed up for some gambling activity and filed a disability discrimination charge. And basically he had depression. He was diagnosed with depression. He argued that the depression manifested itself via compulsive gambling behavior. That lawsuit was kicked, because we got very clear language in the ADA that says, look, you know, gambling, compulsive gambling is just not covered by this law. I would expect that that's not going to change anytime soon. Congress can't even pass a budget. I don't see them amending the law to make things better for gamblers. But I don't know, you know, Fanatics and those guys, they spend a lot of money on lobbying, so maybe they will. But at least as it stands right now, I don't see any meaningful protections under the ADA. What about state law? Most states, right? You know, probably every state has their own disability discrimination law. And then a lot of counties and municipalities, right, in those states have their own disability or just general anti-discrimination laws, but specifically disability discrimination laws. And a lot of those state laws, right, are drafted differently than Congress might have drafted the ADA. And in fact, a lot of those laws have probably a better path of protection for the gambling addict. And what I mean by that is in 40 states, their disability discrimination laws are silent on gambling. So we don't have that compulsive gambling exclusion that exists in the ADA, doesn't exist in the state disability discrimination law, right? So there's nothing that you can point to say, you know, the drafters specifically intended not to protect gambling. And if we look at that New Haven case with the police chief, You know, Connecticut's law, for example, they have a disability discrimination law, and they define a mental disability. You have a mental disability if you have a record of or regarded as having one or more mental disorders as defined in the most recent edition of the DSM, right? So not, you know, version 3, version 4, it's just the most recent edition. And so I just told you that gambling disorder is covered in the DSM-5. So in Connecticut, a gambling disorder actually should be recognized as a mental disability under that state's disability discrimination law. State laws can provide greater protections than federal laws. So, you know, does it make sense that, you know, a gambling disorder isn't protected under the ADA, but it might be protected, even though not specifically, but it could be covered under a state law? It doesn't make a lot of sense, but that's just the way the system works. And the idea is to try to know those rules. And so lots of states have laws that provide more protections, like silently, right? But they have definitions of mental disabilities that are broad enough that a gambling disorder could very well be protected. Other states don't, right? So there's a bunch of states that just mimic the ADA exclusion. And some pretty big states like California, you know, you ever been there? Right? Ever heard of it? Right? There's, you know, Ohio, right? Some big places, Colorado, just mimic the ADA's rules. I think there's like 8 or 9. So I have a list: California, Colorado, Indiana, Kentucky, Maine, Nebraska, Ohio, Oregon, South Carolina, Utah. So those are the states that just take the ADA's exclusion, and their disability discrimination laws don't cover, you know, gambling disorder. Interesting side note in comparison, if we take the state laws that allow sports betting, right? I told you basically, you know, 40 states allow betting, 30 of them allow the apps. If we like take the states that allow sports betting, we superimpose that over the states that, you know, don't, that specifically exclude gambling disorder, you see like a list of consistent states. And so there's, three states, California, South Carolina, Utah, they are consistent. They restrict sports betting, right? And they exclude gambling addiction. So it's like anti-gambling, right? California, South Carolina, Utah. Then there's these, what I call the confused states, the other ones. So Colorado, Indiana, Kentucky, Maine, Nebraska, Ohio, Oregon, they allow sports betting, but they still, in their disability discrimination law, exclude gambling addiction. So they just got like their head in the sand in terms of their state law. And probably a lot of dissonance, you know, in those states when it comes to protections. And so, you know, you're pretty much out of luck at the federal level with respect to disability discrimination, but you're in better shape, you know, at the state level. And, you know, where does that leave us? You know, and why are we, you know, talking about it? Because people are betting, man. You know, people are using their apps and they're betting online, you know. And that may be perfectly fine for the vast majority of people who, you know, enjoy that and have fun and can gamble responsibly. And the problem is that you're going to have members who can't and don't realize that until they're in too deep and in debt. And whether that manifests itself by somebody stealing from the narcotics fund, as allegedly happened in that police department in Connecticut, or some other way, we may wind up dealing with that stuff. And again, we deal with the consequences, and you can't say, oh, I have a disability to avoid any consequences. But, you know, what if we have somebody who's jammed up on the front end? And in public safety agencies, right, we're talking about special categories of employees, you know, who are held to a higher standard. And, you know, many of the agencies where people are listening to this, you might have, I mean, you certainly had credit checks or, you know, money checks on the hiring end. Some people have obligations to report any credit issues. It's rare, but, you know, sometimes those things come up. You certainly have obligations to report any, most instances, any type of, you know, arrests or off-duty misconduct that might blow back on the department. In a lot of the states, by the way, where we allow sports betting, you can report yourself. It's a weird, it's almost like if you, you're addicted to chocolate chip cookies and you got a cookie jar and you wire it so that every time you open the cookie jar, you get a shock on your finger, right? So you're not going to eat the cookies when you get the shock. States have self-reporting laws, so you can, report yourself to the state to say, listen, I'm a problem gambler, right? You know, and I can't be going into these casinos or I can't be using a sports app because, you know, that's it. My wife's going to kick me out or for whatever reason, right? You can self-report. And there are procedures in the state laws that will say, okay, well, if that's the case, you're on the list and you can't go into a casino or you can't use a sports app, you can't whatever. And sometimes there are consequences. And if you go into a casino and you're on the list, like maybe you're trespassing, right? And so, you know, is there an obligation to report that to your department? If you're on any type of list, we don't like lists on the law enforcement end, especially as it might relate to like Brady or Giglio obligations. Is, you know, if we find out that the government maintains a list of somebody who said works for a police department and says they're a problem gambler, what obligation do you have to disclose that to defense in a case? I think that's kind of far afield, but you know, we see these things, you know, I can, part of what we try to do on the podcast and at LRS seminars is to see like what's coming down the pike and, you know, to try to predict, you know, what problems we might see. Hopefully just to kind of see, is there anything we can do to get out in front of it? And, you know, where it really comes down to, I think, you know, in how do we get out in front of this is, you know, what do we do for something like alcohol? You know, because I think marijuana, you've heard me say this on the podcast before, marijuana is basically like beer now. It's going to become beer. You know, once we get to, you know, 40 states that are recreational, if we ever get there, there's been some pushback lately, maybe we won't. But if we get to that point where it's essentially marijuana is a recreational drug and things change at the federal level, right, which it seems like they're probably going to do, go back and listen to my podcast about the Hermani case and the schedule change. You know, we're going to have to deal with the reality that marijuana is just like beer, right? It's just something people can engage in. It's otherwise lawful. How do we regulate that in the workplace? Same thing with gambling, right? You know, gambling is lawful. Sports betting is lawful. How do we allow people, how do we allow a police officer or a firefighter to engage in otherwise lawful conduct that their neighbors can engage in, right? But prevent that from harming the workplace and harming themselves or coworkers, you know, at work. And so, you know, if we treat, you know, gambling like alcohol, remember that, you know, under the ADA, you know, the employer has things they can do, right? They can prohibit the use of alcohol in the workplace, right? You can require that, that people not be under the influence of alcohol at work. You can hold, employees with alcoholism to the same, you know, standards as anybody else. You still got to be able to do the job regardless of what disability you might suffer from. And you can't just say, we'll point to that or, you know, as a crutch. Do we do the same thing with gambling, right? And gambling disorder, because we know that it's out there. And so if we do, you know, what are some things that, that we can talk about at the bargaining table, or let's not wait to then, deal with at the policy level, deal with right now, to get to gambling. You know, an easy one is make sure if you have EAP, you know, make sure that it covers gambling addiction, you know, specifically, right? What gambling addiction options do we have, you know, as an agency that we're holding out, you know, to members to use? And if, you know, there's distrust, there's always distrust. Hey, employers, cover your ears. There's always distrust of EAP. Everyone thinks it's like, you know, everything you say is going to get back and get all over the department. Maybe it's true. Maybe it's not. In my experience, it's, that generally hasn't been true, but there's certainly a lack of trust oftentimes from the rank and file of EAP. So if, you know, if employer sponsored EAP doesn't address this, what are some things that maybe the union can do, or what are some resources that the union can secure to try to help members who may be suffering from a gambling addiction? You know, are there any reporting obligations? Are there abilities if somebody winds up, you know, stuck, and they have some major debt situations or some problems that they're now facing because of a gambling addiction? You know, if they self-report, you know, is there any assistance that they might be able to secure, from the department? And if they do self-report, what happens, right? You know, what type of education are we providing to officers and to firefighters about the risks of online gaming? Can we just, by the way, can we just ban it? I don't know. Maybe. Could you bargain a requirement? Could you say the Rick Paulson Police Department, we're going to have a rule that you can't gamble. Yeah, it's otherwise lawful, but there's no use of online gaming apps. I suppose you could. You know, I think that probably should be bargained. It's a standard. How do you enforce it? Tough to enforce. Does that go a little far? Probably. You could ban drinking, right? you could ban any number of things. I think that probably goes a little far afield, but you certainly can ban the use of, personal cell phones for gambling, right? You can ban the use of employer routers, right, to access, gaming sites. There are any number of things that can be addressed. And I think the key there is to make sure that the employer's expectations are clear, right? Of course, we can never have financial misconduct, but to make sure, like, what is the policy? Do we have buy-in from the union level? Are we communicating that policy to members so that they know what they can do and what they can't do? And then how do we deal with failure? Because we know there's always going to be failure, right? People are going to violate policies, and there's, I really, truly, there's nothing wrong with that. That's natural. There's going to be a certain degree of that. We don't want too much of that, but we know there's going to be some. So how do we deal with violations of policy? And that's where progressive discipline comes in. And so those are all the things that we should be talking about, really at the agency level. If you're interested, in the show notes, if you want your draft language, I can send you some language on that. I've got a provision that we've been playing around with in bargaining to try to get out in front of this. And it's really not, it's not that complicated. And there's no magic to it, but let's just say it's an officer who voluntarily discloses a gambling related problem prior to any known investigation or allegation of misconduct shall not be subject to discipline solely for the act of disclosure. Upon such disclosure, the department shall offer the employee a confidential referral to the employee assistance program or other appropriate treatment resources. Participation in such programs shall be treated as confidential medical information to the extent permitted by law. Nothing in this provision shall preclude the department from investigating or disciplining any underlying conduct, including but not limited to theft, fraud, or policy violations. And this provision applies only to voluntary disclosures made before the commencement of an investigation or the discovery of misconduct. And so, that's just one way of approaching it. There are probably 1,000 ways that you can get to the issue just as well or probably better. But do we try to bargain something so that we can incentivize people to disclose problems that they're facing in a way that's non-disciplinary, tries to get to a problem before it becomes a big, big problem where it manifests itself at work, but also sets really clear rules regarding performance and says that you can't just like pull the gambling disorder thing out of your hat after there's an investigation into you stealing from the firehouse, food fund, right? So we want to provide incentives for people to ask for help. And departments, if you're going to do that, you better follow through in a reasonable way. I've had so many cases over the years where people have voluntarily disclosed something and then they've gotten fired, after the fact. What a way to kill credibility in a program to do that. So it takes work. But if you put that work into it and sit down to it, I think that you can get to something that can help your members and help your departments. And, I've seen this, these gambling addictions are tough, man, because the debts are crazy. The debts are crazy. People can ring up debts that are, really, really scary. And in an industry where I haven't even mentioned post-traumatic stress, I don't think, this podcast, although it usually comes up one way or another in a podcast, we know about post-traumatic stress. We know about the very high incidence of suicide among public safety professionals. If we can do something to help somebody avoid placing themselves in a really significant hole, where they could really think like the best thing, the only way out here, the best way out for me and my family is for me to end this, and harm myself. If we can find a way to minimize the number of occasions where that happens, then I would hope that we would try to do everything that we possibly can. And so, that's maybe a not so fast overview of gambling disorder. Starting to see it. Really interested in ways that agencies are starting to get to that issue. And again, if you have any better suggestions, please share them with us. And we'll talk about it at seminars and maybe the next episode of the podcast. I'll report back. By the way, hopefully, when I'm talking to you in June, the Sixers will still be playing. If I were a betting man, I would suggest that that's probably wouldn't be the case, but I'm not a betting man. So that's about it. Hey, thanks a lot for listening, everybody. If you like the podcast, just please share it, text it, do whatever it is people do with podcasts. If you have any questions about any of the stuff we do at LRAS, just Google us at LRAS.com. If you have any questions about any of the stuff that we talk about or any requests for subjects that you would like us to talk about, just shoot us an email at info@LRAS.com. Okay, I think I covered all the bases. Thank you so much for listening this month. I hope you have a wonderful month and talk to you in the month of June. Signing off, Rick Polson.